Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson.
Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. I've been writing about the culture war for as long as I've been writing about politics, which is 17, 18 years, something like that, not only because I'm more interested in the way culture impacts politics and vice versa than I am in strictly politics, but because the culture is really where it all begins. As the late, great Andrew Breitbart, the man who first gave me an opportunity to write about politics and culture, was fond of saying, politics flows downstream from culture. And I often say that conservatives haven't even been in a position to fight a culture war because the left has been so successful at capturing all of our cultural institutions. So I usually say we've only been in a position to wage a culture insurgency. And for many years, we've accomplished very little in that asymmetric conflict. We haven't even slowed the momentum of the culture agenda of the left. But now, in the age of Trump, for the first time, conservatives seem to have reversed the momentum. We seem to be racking up win after win in terms of dismantling DEI programs, rooting out or at least exposing progressive bias in education, rejecting the excesses of gender ideology, and so on. It's been a remarkable turnaround, and hey, all it took, or at least what galvanized it, was having a conservative president who has some understanding of how pop culture works and how important that arena is. A president and a few other political leaders like Ron DeSantis, who are willing to get down in the trenches of the culture war and do what it takes to win. Today I've got a very sharp guest upcoming who wrote an interesting and hopeful take for National Review on the culture wars. He also wrote a book on how the culture war got underway in the first place and how we got to where we are today. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we are having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a contributing editor in National Review. He has taught at Harvard and University of Chicago, and he's the author of Radical in Chief, Barack Obama and the Untold Story of American Socialism, and Spreading the Wealth, How Obama is Robbing the Suburbs to Pay for the Cities. He's also the author of a short book called The Lost History of Western Civilization, which I want to talk a bit about today. A true scholar and a gentleman, Stanley Kurtz, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Stanley, I've been writing about the culture war for many years, not as long as you, because the culture is where it all begins. As Andrew Breitbart was fond of saying, politics flows downstream from culture. And I often say that the left has been so successful at capturing all of our cultural institutions that conservatives have really only been able to wage a very ineffective culture insurgency. But now, with Trump at the helm, it seems like for the first time conservatives seem to have the momentum. It's like the left has made its long march through the institutions, but the right now is making a blitzkrieg, a lightning war, and recapturing some of that territory. And then your recent article at National Review called The Conservative Cultural Comeback caught my attention, and I thought it was important to bring you on to talk about it. You begin that article by asking a couple of questions, and I'll just ask them to you now. Is wokeness dying? And are conservatives actually winning the culture wars?
Well, thanks, Mark. Yes, those are the questions, and they're in the air, just as you've been feeling them. And I basically tried to think out the very difficult answers to those questions. And I began with a kind of thought experiment, which I think is perfectly plausible, not something that certainly will happen, but that could happen. I said to myself, what would happen if Republicans were to win two successive terms of the presidency after President Trump? You know, that obviously is not guaranteed, but it certainly could happen. If that were to happen, you'd have, by the end of it, you'd have almost certainly an 8-1 conservative majority on the Supreme Court, 8-1. And all of Trump's executive orders, the many, many orders he's already put out on things like eliminating affirmative action, even going back to President Johnson's original 1965 executive order, blocking men in girls' sports, to fixing up the way the Smithsonian and other museums present American history. All of that large flurry of executive orders would have been in effect for 12 years, even if Congress did not turn them all into law. So would that mean that we had won the culture war? I guess the bottom line on my end is, yes, it would mean conservative dominance in the culture war, and that would be a very big, earth-shattering even event. But on the other hand, I don't think it would mean that the culture war would be over. And we can get into this, but I think there are certain basic underlying features of American life right now that mean we're going to be having a culture war for a very long time, as far as the eye can see. So I don't think the culture wars will end, and we can talk about why I think that's the case.
Yeah, I'm literally praying for 8 years of J.D. Vance after Trump, partly because I have a man crush on Vance. But as you note in your article, the radicals of the 1960s completed their long march through the institutions right under the noses of the center-right political class. And you ask in the piece, why would there be any reason to expect a different outcome this time? So are conservatives reclaiming some cultural dominance, but only unwittingly setting ourselves up to be subverted again?
Right. I think there's truth on both sides of that argument. Going back to your first point, it is absolutely true that although we had center-right presidencies from Richard Nixon right through George W. Bush. And by that, I mean that even Jimmy Carter was relatively toward the center for a Democrat. And Bill Clinton, of course, is famous for having launched a kind of centrist Democratic position, although Hillary tended to pull him further to the left. But we've had a long streak during which people, I think, rightly said America is a center-right country. And yet, during all those decades, that is when political correctness rose. That is when the left conducted its long march through the institutions. That is when the left took control of the culture war. So just because President Trump is in office now, and just because, say, J.D. Vance may have two terms after, why would any of that change? And I think there is a reason to think that it would change, because when you go back and look at those earlier presidencies, even Ronald Reagan did not focus on reversing the culture war. It's true that under Reagan and then H.W. Bush, you had William Bennett and then Lynn Cheney doing a wonderful, even heroic job of fighting the culture war rhetorically, opposing the elimination of the Western civilization requirement at Stanford and many other issues. And that was very important to the culture, I think. But ultimately, it failed to stop the long march of the left. And already, in just 6 months, President Trump has negated, as I mentioned, President Johnson's original 1965 executive order authorizing affirmative action, which even Ronald Reagan did not negate. There were people in his administration that wanted to. He considered it, but in the end, he kind of backed down. And already, President Trump has tied federal aid to higher education to a program of conservative reform. And not a single Republican president did that in decades. So on the one hand, I think that at this moment, President Trump's actions, which are thrilling the conservative base, has transformed the party going forward. And that presidents from now on who are Republican are going to fight these cultural battles in a way that we've never fought them prior to President Trump. And I think that means that political dominance now means much more than it meant in those past decades. But at the same time, I will say again, I think there's some underlying social arrangements that we're living through in this modern, or maybe could call it postmodern era, that mean that the forces behind the left side of the culture war are not going to be completely defeated anytime soon. So it's going to move back and forth, the culture war, but perhaps with conservative dominance, perhaps we'll be at least winning, relatively speaking, for a couple of decades. That could happen, and it hasn't happened up to now.
Yes. Let's back up in history a little bit. The left has known for almost 100 years how crucial an arena culture is, going all the way back to the Frankfurt School of Intellectuals, the cultural Marxists of the 20s and 30s and 40s, and they've been working assiduously since then to dominate that battleground. Why has it taken conservatives so long to recognize the significance of the culture and to start doing something about it?
That's a great question. I think that the reluctance of Republicans to fight the culture war, I mean Republican political office holders, has been immensely frustrating for decades. I think there are a number of causes. I think that many Republican politicians and Republican donors tend to be in business. They didn't necessarily take liberal arts courses when they were in college themselves. And on the one hand, that saved them from being taken over by the virus of political correctness. On the other hand, I think it led them to first not fully recognize how important our educational and cultural institutions were. There was a feeling abroad, I think, among establishment Republicans that however silly some of these campus demonstrations were or some of these professors were, when students graduate and begin to pay taxes, they'll kind of buckle down and get sensible. But it turned out that that's not the way things worked out. And it took a while to make people realize that. I remember I started writing publicly about 2000, and I used to bang my head against the wall to explain to conservative donors and politicians how important it was that we had lost K-12 and higher education. And they couldn't take it seriously. And now, for the last few years, since the George Floyd and all of that, they come to me and say, Stanley, you know, what can we do? How can we fix this? So I think something big happened when all of the woke stuff spilled out of the academy and came into the businesses, into the human relations offices of businesses. And then what people like me learned from a life in higher education became real to ordinary people out in the workaday world. And that's what has really turned the corner.
Yeah. And also, I think one of the things that conservatives have done to push back is wielding the levers of federal power. You pointed out in your article, in fact, that under Trump, the levers of federal power have been used across the entire range of culture war issues, sometimes for the very first time on behalf of conservative goals. And as the activist Chris Rufo argues, conservatives who generally are rather opposed on principle to wielding federal power, they're going to have to get comfortable doing that in order to win and keep winning the culture war. Would you agree with that?
I do. I mean, I myself am torn on that. I certainly want much more involvement by all levels of government in the cultural battles than we've seen up to now. And in that sense, I've been very frustrated, as you have, I'm sure, by the Republican establishment. At the same time, I do greatly value federalism, and there are important issues, especially in education and in other areas as well, that I think are fundamentally should remain responsibilities of the state. And we have to remember that that's not just some kind of overly cautious adherence to principle. In a very concrete way, I think the conservative strength in the battle over schools lies with parents. And parents have the most power at the local level. And the further away you get from parents, even though we happen to have the presidency now, the more likely it is that education bureaucrats, even in red states, still tend to move to the left. And if the Democrats get in control, they will try to nationalize education and push it to the left. And actually, I think in a very concrete way, politically and strategically, the conservative strength is through local control. But having said that, I broadly agree with you that the Republican Party has been way too shy about exercising its power. For example, I do a lot of model legislation on education, and one of my most ambitious pieces of legislation is based on the power that state legislatures have to require courses for graduation at public universities. You can transform public universities by carefully thought through use of that power. And I have a model legislation called the General Education Act, a version of which has just passed in Utah, that will truly transform public universities there. And it all comes from using a power which we have a lot of historical precedent for and which is perfectly legitimate on the state level. These states created public universities, and they legitimately can exercise a great deal of control over them, but they've been reluctant to do so. So I think that sort of thing needs to be pushed to the nth degree.
And what about contemporary or recent cultural controversies like mass immigration and defunding the police and gender ideology? Those issues weren't originally part of the culture war battlegrounds. How have these recent developments altered the face or the direction of the culture war, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. And I do think that one of the reasons conservatives are either winning or just totally reversing the momentum of the culture war is that some of the original issues like abortion and gay marriage or gay partnerships and school choice have now been supplemented by issues that would have been hard to even imagine back when the culture war began in the 80s and early 90s. This idea that crime should not be punished, basically, that you should let, shoplifting go unpunished, which is just shocking. But in California, broadly speaking, that's their policy, or that you should have open borders. Of course, immigration's been an issue for a long time, but the idea that you should have open borders and that anything less than that is a moral abomination, and the hostility to fossil fuels, the attempt really to destroy fossil fuels, which is economically insane, that has become a huge cultural issue. And these are all issues on which conservatives and Republicans are basically winning. So if you put that together with the more closely fought original issues, you could certainly make a case that Republicans are winning the culture war. But the problem with that is that the left still, despite their current problems, which are very serious, they still are in place as the cultural elite in the institutions which really control society. The faculty at these universities, no matter what President Trump does in terms of federal money cutoffs and imposing agreements like we've seen with Columbia University, you still have this far-left faculty. You still have far-left newsrooms. You still have far-left Hollywood, although it is changing enough so that some conservatives are, you know, coming out into the open in Hollywood maybe a little bit more than they used to. But broadly speaking, the left is still in control of the dominant institutions of society. That's why my feeling is that if you have to call it, I would say the culture war is tied. Yeah. I'd say it's about tied because conservatives are winning on the majority of issues, not all of them, but the majority. But the left still has this root of cultural power. And there's one other critical factor that I go into in the article, and that is that after the sexual revolution and with the extended period of education that we now have as preparation for many jobs, we're seeing between the 1950s and the present day, the age of first marriage, the median age of first marriage, has crept up from about 20 for women to about 28. For men, it's a year or two higher. And then it's even higher for college, as you would think, for highly educated people, which makes up the bulk of the Democratic Party. And so when you spend a good a decade or more, substantially more, living as a single person without being married, then you're going to want a liberal sexual morality. You're going to want access to abortion. Gay marriage is kind of an ultimate symbol of traditional sexual morality. And you're even going to want identity politics, because identity politics is one of the few ways left in our society to have a feeling of community, a feeling of group solidarity. It's unfortunate that that's true, but I think that's one of the motivators. So as long as we have this extended singlehood, which has really become, in effect, almost a new life stage, I think we're going to have wokeness, we're going to have culture wars. That doesn't mean the balance of power can't shift toward conservatives, but I don't see a complete victory or social transformation coming within any of our lifetimes.
Yeah, I think you just anticipated my next question, which was about another quote that I wanted to pull from your article, which has so many great ideas in it. I'm just going to keep plucking quotes and asking you about them. You note in the article that the most important bulwark of leftist cultural power is rarely remarked upon. The true secret of the culture war, you write, is its grounding in the way that we live. And I think you just alluded to that when you talked about that lifestyle of extended singlehood and some of the left-leaning lifestyle requirements that go along with that. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more about the true secret of the culture war being in the way that we live?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a wonderful book by a guy named Alan Ehrenhold called The Lost City. He's not particularly conservative, but his book is really an attempt to describe community as it existed in America in the 1950s. Now, you might not think that a sort of traditional community was strong in the United States in the 1950s, but it was compared to the way it is now. And Ehrenhold has a wonderful chapter in there where he talks about a parish in Chicago. They used to call their sections of the cities parishes, which, of course, a lot of the immigrants were Catholic. And basically, you had a lot of families living in row houses, and the men all were working in the factory, and the women were at home watching the kids. And there was a real sense of community there, such that the kids would play in the alleyways behind the roadhouses. And it was understood that parents could discipline even other children if the kids had moved up to your end of the alleyway. And if someone started playing around on his wife or whatever, people would in the community would sort of talk to him and try to settle him down. If that didn't work, they would go to the parish priest, who knew all of these families, and they knew him. That's a community, and that's the kind of social situation that is needed to sustain traditional morality. And also, if you just think about the symbolism of religion, the core symbolism of Christianity is of sacrifice. And what people would do there would be in that community was to sacrifice themselves for other people in their communities and their families. And what meaning does all of that have to individuals who are sort of living in the city alone and single for 10 years, and they entertain themselves by, I don't know what they do now, but going to the disco is what they might have done before, and having a hookup culture there. It's obviously that's going to be connected to the culture wars that have really came in the 1960s. And I don't see any imminent change in the lifestyle. I'm not saying that young single people can't become traditional or conservative or religious, but I think there's without a fundamental change in lifestyle, you're still going to have a large cohort of people who are going to embrace the values of the left side of the culture war, and so the battle will go on.
Yeah, and one of the upsides for conservatives is, as you point out in the article, the left provides no true alternative social template. Over time, their cultural solutions always collapse. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. So that someone could say, I think, with make a good argument that, well, you know, we're never going to go back to the 50s. We're never going to go back to the world that Alan Ehrenhold described. Women are in the workforce and things are just going to be different. But you could equally turn to the left and say, well, what is your alternative? What have you got to offer in the way of an actual alternative social reality? If you go back to the 60s, you'll see that, you know, the hippie communes, they all collapsed. They collapsed because the young people in those communes wanted absolute equality, and they also wanted absolute freedom, and they couldn't really have both. And that contradiction destroyed the communes by causing all sorts of arguments. And then the SDS, like the left during the French Revolution, the SDS in the 60s sort of got more and more extreme and collapsed into these warring factions, and the whole thing fell apart. And then you had the people who tuned in, turned on, and dropped out, and they basically burned out from too much drugs. Now, if you go to what happened after George Floyd, they had in Seattle, and then I think in Portland as well, they had these autonomous zones that really collapsed in anarchy when they actually had people patrolling those areas with guns. But pretty soon people started dying and the whole thing collapsed, and they had to bring the police back. Black Lives Matter had all of these corruption scandals, and we're still living with the collapse, slow motion collapse of our cities from that impulse to abolish the police and not enforce crime. So you've got this situation where things have changed in a way that make it hard to imagine going back to the 50s, but simultaneously, the left really only offers criticism. They don't offer a viable alternative way of life. And I think for a long time, we're going to be caught in the back and forth between those two sides. But again, that doesn't mean that the conservatives might not gain much greater dominance, like that thought experiment where we, say, get two terms of J.D. Vance.
Yes. Let's return to the origin of the culture war. I want to get to your book, The Lost History of Western Civilization, which kind of ties into or sort of leads into the article that we've been discussing. The book that you wrote back in 2020, The Lost History of Western Civilization, you begin that by referring to the infamous incident back in 1987, which I remember well, actually, when Jesse Jackson led students at Stanford University in chants of, "Hey ho, hey ho, Western Civ has got to go." And you kind of trace from that point as more or less the beginning, or maybe at least maybe the most explicit, direct opening salvo of the culture war. Is that right?
Yes, I think that was a crucial origin point. And if you think about it, Jesse Jackson at that time, he made two presidential runs, I think the first one in 1984 and then one in 1988. And really what he was doing at Stanford there was kind of stirring up support for his presidential run. The Stanford people who wanted to eliminate Western Civ were called the Stanford Rainbow Coalition. And that was also the name of Jesse Jackson's thing. And at the time, Jesse Jackson was kind of marginal to the Democratic Party. He had to be accommodated. He made some very powerful speeches at the two Democratic conventions he was at, but he didn't really expect to get the nomination. He was really imagining that he would have more leverage. He wanted to have leverage for his side. But at that time, the Democrats were focused on economics. Of course, James Carville famously said, "It's the economy, stupid." And there were a lot of liberals who wanted to focus on economics, and they didn't want all of this multiculturalism that Jesse Jackson was talking about. They thought that would alienate the working class. So on the one hand, we've got, say, Pat Buchanan on the Republican side, who was kind of marginal to the establishment, H.W. Bush, but who was very much into fighting these culture war issues. And then we have Jesse Jackson. And I think over time, each party has been taken over by these cultural issues and their own establishments pushed out, because the culture war kind of became American politics. But what I did in that book was to look at a little bit of a different aspect of the Stanford battle than most people have looked at, because there was an intellectual justification that the professors gave who wanted to eliminate the Western Civ requirement. They all they hung their hats on an article by a guy named Gilbert Allardyce, who claimed that the whole idea of Western civilization was a late invention. It was just created just after during World War I to kind of dupe young American boys into going and fighting in World War I for Europe. And that prior to that, there was no real idea of Western Civ in the United States. Colleges didn't teach about it. And this is an example of deconstructionist history. This wave of deconstructionism has moved into academia, which basically goes after any idea of Americanness or Westernness, any hint of cultural unity, of something we can be proud of and rally around, and they try to debunk it and deconstruct it. And I basically said, well, these people are never critically examined themselves. And I looked at the arguments that Western Civ is all an invention, and I said they're all bogus. And I go through a lot of time and effort to show basically that this is nonsense, that Americans have been studying Western Civ since before the United States existed. Now, it wasn't called Western civilization in the earlier times. It was called European civilization. It's not very different. It was just understood that America represents a kind of extension of European culture. So there was a bit of a name change, but there were some great and very influential historians who I talk about in the book who are really very interesting, like François Guizot, a great French historian who deeply influenced John Stuart Mill and Alexis de Tocqueville, William Robertson. So deconstructionism, this idea, and the deconstructionists really are victims of their own perspective, because not only do they go around debunking the specific pillars of Western and American identity, but they can't really stop themselves in the end from debunking everything. And this goes back to our point about the 60s not really providing, or the left in general, not providing a real alternative. The intellectual side of that coin is that the deconstructionists ended up deconstructing everything. They really found it impossible to believe in any positive way of life, in any model of the good society. All they can do is tear down, and I examined that problem in some detail in the book.
Yeah, and multiculturalism, that's become such a huge aspect of the left-wing worldview, hasn't it? It's indoctrinated at least a couple of generations of Americans and Westerners abroad into believing that the West is uniquely somehow oppressive and exploitative and racist and evil, frankly. Let's end our conversation on an inspirational note, if we can. Why is the West the best? Why is it important that we fight in the culture, in the schools, in the media, in the entertainment arena, to transmit this grand legacy of the West down to younger generations and to fight for its continued flourishing?
Well, I think the core idea of the West is the importance of the individual and therefore of liberty, of freedom. And so I think the importance of the individual, society being for the sake of the individual rather than the individual for the sake of society, that is the founding idea, the core idea. Individual equality and freedom are the core ideas of liberal democracy in the classic sense. I think that's the real meaning of the West. And of course, we've had these challenges from fascism and communism. But when you study Western Civ, you're really studying the long, long history of the emergence of liberal democracy based on the idea of the individual. And one of the things I stress in the book is that the truth is the left, although it doesn't want to admit it, has adopted this idea of the individual. I would almost say that one of their main problems is that they push it too far. So if you think about, and I do an analysis there of the word Latinx, Latinx. What is Latinx? Latinx is an attempt to eliminate the gendered ending of Spanish words. And so what they're really saying is that's a kind of pro-trans idea. You can choose your own gender. What could be more individualist than the idea that I'm going to choose my own gender, that biology has no control over that? Now, I happen to think that's an overextension of the idea of individualism. But the truth is, while these people who like Latinx fancy themselves to be a kind of modern version of ancient pre-colonial American Indians, the truth is they are extreme examples of modern Western individualism. And if they don't read John Locke and the Western great books, they won't understand where they themselves are coming from.
Yes. And what do you say to those people on the left, or even on the right, who associate Western civilization with white identity politics?
Well, I think that's a bogus argument, you know, brought by the other side. And I've just, in a sense, made the case to refute that. Because, again, any group, any ethnic group, it's almost impossible to imagine that any ethnic or racial minority at a contemporary American university isn't essentially a modern Western individualist. They really couldn't function very well at the university if they weren't already assimilated into Western liberal modernity in that sense. And so, again, we all share this across racial and ethnic boundaries. And so if you stop yourself from understanding the legacy of the West's great books and of liberal democracy, which is founded on these ideas, you are preventing yourself from understanding yourself, and regardless of your skin color or ethnicity. And this is the great error of the left.
Yes. Stanley, dare I ask if you have a new book somewhere on the horizon?
You can ask. I don't, you know, this piece that you have invited me here to talk about is a more ambitious than usual piece. And I suppose I could try to write a book about the culture war. And I am sort of trying to think more deeply about it by reading up on the history of the culture war. I suppose a book had come out of that, but the fact of the matter is, in the last few years, I have focused my work on actually fighting the culture war. So as I've told you, I have various pieces of model legislation as focused on transforming both K-12 and higher education. So I'm kind of torn. What I used to do was to write books and articles, and I was very pleased with myself if I put out one that I thought was nice, or if someone said something nice to me about it. But then in 2015, when all of this woke stuff started taking over, and I remember in particular that a conference on free speech at Yale that was put on by the William Buckley Institute, the sort of conservative student group at Yale, it was attacked by liberal students. And nowadays, we wouldn't bat an eye at the idea of leftist students attacking free speech. But in 2015, I found it shocking, because usually the left would at least pretend that they were in favor of free speech. So when that happened, I said to myself, I've written on these higher ed issues for 15 years, and I haven't made a damn bit of difference. It's getting worse, not better. And that's when I started doing the model legislation.
Yeah. How can people keep up with what you're doing and writing and working on? Are you a social media guy?
I'm not. I'm not.
Me either.
I spend a lot of effort not making a quick gut level reaction to things that happen and saying something stupid that will make people try to discredit me for my, you know, silliness. And all of a sudden Twitter came around, the whole purpose of which was to make you give a quick gut reaction and say something stupid so people can attack you. And so I find Twitter an abomination for that reason. It's just not the way I work. I like to work at a level of greater forethought. But I write regularly on education issues for National Review Online. And also I have, there's a scholars page where you can look up my work at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, which is my think tank. There's a page where just about everything I write is posted after it's been published.
Good to know. Stanley Kurtz, thanks for joining us at The Right Take. Please keep up the great work, sir.
Thanks so much, Mark.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us. Check out Stanley's work. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.